Hello, I'm Kara Gard, and welcome to Tea Time with Tech Marketing Leaders.
Welcome back to the show. For those joining us live, please, please, please comment. I can't see you unless I see you. We are here and paying attention to the comments, and we want to know who you are and where you're from, and then your questions, most importantly, because that's the beauty of being live, is we get to have a conversation in real time. And Juan and I are here for it. So let's go. Let's go. Good morning, Juan. It's very morning. It's
It is
early.
very morning. Yes, I am currently dialing in from Melbourne, Australia at 6:03 a.m. and I'm excited. I've woken up. I've already had my morning coffee, so I'm ready to jump into the show.
Six oh three. 6:03. Well, it is 9:04 my time. We are literally halfway around the world from each other. I am in the UK. And Juan, where specifically are you?
So I'm based down in Melbourne, Australia. So that's the southern part of Australia. It's like probably the furthest away from everywhere else in the world, apart from say Tasmania, which is a small island just off the southern coast of Australia. So I'm down here in Australia. I've been here for about 10 years now, and we love it. It's a beautiful place to live, but it's a very small population. It's only the population of Australia is only half the size of California. So being a marketer, I guess, and doing marketing down here is very different compared to in places like Europe or in the UK where you are, Kerry, or even in the United States as well.
I actually think I have you maybe a little beat. So I'm on an island in the channel between England and France. We have about 60,000 people in this little nook of the world. But I love what you're talking about in terms of marketing being so different. What's different for you? I'm sorry, we're jumping the gun, y'all. I'm all over the place because it's too good to pass up. What's different for you in terms of being in a smaller population and being part of marketing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess in my own journey with the MarTech Weekly, and we'll get into what that is in a minute. So because we have a smaller population in a from a marketing technology perspective, like doing digital marketing, it really benefits from scale, from having a lot of people. I mean, you know, if anything, the internet allowed marketers to do things with millions, billions of people at scale. When you're looking at like regional marketing and marketing and brands that are distinctly Australian, we have less customers, so we actually have to sweat all of our other our capabilities to actually convert those customers, to get more value out of them, to serve them well. And so, what I see down in Australia is this really unique maturity around marketing technology, from everything from personalization to A/B testing to ad tech and optimizing ads, all the way through to say even just email marketing and CRM. What I see is an increase in maturity and compared to other parts of the world, because we just need to get more dollar out of our customers down here. That's just the stark reality. So we work much harder to really make the experiences great for customers, because we know there's only so many of them. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is that I call Australia kind of the land of duopolies. I mean, we've kind of got two airlines, and we've got, you know, sort of three or four banks. You know, like we only have so many companies that can be big enough to substantiate like big budgets in marketing, because our population's so small. And so I think that like with that, and in conjunction with like we're having to work harder and sweat your technologies as a marketer harder, it means that there's a very small community of people here that like are really elite, that really get this stuff done and almost, I think, show the future of what you can do with some of these marketing technologies. And then there's kind of everyone else, you know, there's the tiny mom and pop businesses and the corner shop around the corner, you know, and that kind of thing. And so and I probably should mention one last thing, which is probably the most exciting, is that I'm seeing increasingly in Australia, the breakout brands in Australia tend to be global first. So we have companies here like Canva, you know, and everyone knows what Canva is, right? It's an incredible, yeah. And I was traveling to San Francisco just 3 or 4 months ago. And when I arrived in the airport, every single ad on the billboards in the airport were Canva ads. And that's their target market. Digital people that work in San Francisco. But it's an Australian brand. You know, it's based and founded and still operated out of Sydney. And we have Atlassian, which is behind Jira and Confluence, you know, and we have other companies like Linktree, which is actually just down the road from me, which is a breakout, you know, more than $1 billion plus valued company. And so we found that, and even with myself, with the Martech Weekly, we found that there's not enough people here. So we actually have to be global first. We have to participate in a global economy if we ever want to make a big business, is because there's just not enough people here. Very different attitudes to say the United States, where there's more than 300 million people. So you can well and truly make, you know, a multiple billions dollar value business just by focusing on that single market. So I think that was sort of the main three things. It's a fascinating place to live and work. It's very remote. I mean, I guess we're in the Southern Hemisphere and down in the surrounded by water, a bit of a fortress down here, but yeah, I love it. It's such a fascinating place to be doing marketing right now.
I have something to add, but before I get there, what's the weather like? Are you in winter right now?
Yeah, we're actually just coming out of winter. We're in spring. So we have like 3 months of winter, and then we have a long spring. So that runs us right through to like December, and then it gets really hot. So it's warming up, which is great, because my goodness, like the winters down here are pretty brutal. You know, it can be very, very cold. So I'm looking forward to some more days outside and more pool parties and hangouts out in the sun, you know.
It's so wild because it's so the opposite. We are having a brutal summer in the U.S. I'm actually, you know, in the U.K., it's been a really weird gray, rainy summer. I'm actually missing the sun desperately, and I don't think we're going to get any this year. But it hasn't been cold. It's been weird. But it's always really fun, like, to hear that your summer starts in December, January. It's just, it's so opposite. It's so wild. This is exciting. Yep. I love this. The other thing I want to say about local marketing, and I'm having sort of the opposite reaction where I live, in that they aren't thinking, because we are connected to the UK and we are connected to Europe, and there is a bit of the US that isn't too far away. The marketing here is actually very interesting and very local. So one of the interesting local elements I've seen that I wish I could find a way to like bring to the, back to the US, I guess, in a niche sort of way, is they do car wrappers or like logos on the side of their cars all the time, because what you do more often here is you drive or you're walking or you're riding your bike and you're looking at cars. And so like the local plumber or the construction worker or the window cleaners, right? They all have marketing on the side of their vans, and it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous, gorgeous marketing with like the catchiest, you know, taglines, because they also can get away with so much more, like leaning into Marvel and adventures and not getting in trouble. So it's a very interesting little local weird part of the world in the opposite sort of way that you're thinking. So I love that. I could talk about this all day, Juan. This is exciting. A little bit about Juan Mendoza is that he's been working on supplying vital insights into the MarTech industry since 2020 as an industry analyst, intersectional keynote speaker, and the author of the MarTech Weekly to help senior leaders work out exactly how the MarTech industry is changing and why. Today, his free Sunday newsletter, go subscribe, and premium newsletter product TMW Pro, and their inaugural international awards event, TMW 100, reaches more than a million marketers across 65 countries, to your point, being global. Look at that. Juan also manages TMW's online community, a regular podcast called Making Sense of MarTech, and frequently collaborates with other publications such as, I want to say WARC, but maybe WARC, is another way of saying it.
You pronounce that like spot on. Most people can't do it. It's like work, but you got it spot on there, Kerry. Good job.
You played the Brits. Living near the Brits. I stage your chief MarTech and the MarTech podcast. Man, you are everywhere. I mean, this is a lot for one person to like have all their like have their hands in. Yeah. So that's sort of a recap of what you wrote on LinkedIn. But tell us your story. Like, this is what you do, but how did you get there? And how did you get your hands in all of these things? And why is that valuable to you?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Kerry. And thanks for the kind and generous introduction there. I mean, I guess I would say one thing as a soundbite, and then I'll explain it. So I think curiosity is probably one of the most powerful forces in your own career, your personal career. I am a 100% believer in that. Like if you're a curious person, if you're exploring the unknown, if you're trying to understand things and you have that passion truly just to create knowledge, I think you're going to go far. That's my first point. Let me explain that, I guess, with my own story. So I originally wasn't working as a marketer. Obviously, I'm a founder, CEO of a media business now, but I was never working as a marketer. I've only been working in marketing for about 7 years. I actually started my career as a chef, and then I did a bunch of nonprofit work for a long time. And then I kind of got this job out of nowhere from a friend that made an introduction with this music tech company. And he said, oh, you know, they're looking for somebody. They're starting up, you know, really interesting music product. They're trying to do something new. And I got into the job as a customer service rep, and it was 2 days a week. And I was like, you know, whoa, this is cool, because I'm used to running around a hot kitchen, you know, opening ovens and, you know, cooking stuff on grills and things like that. And I was like, well, this is kind of cool that like I can sit here on a computer and get paid to do that. And this was like when I was like, you know, in my early 20s. So I basically got into this job, and then it kind of grew because I was just super curious. I was like, whoa, there's all these interesting technologies. They were wanting to launch an e-commerce. So we set up Shopify. They needed a process for like all of their logistics and all of the sort of CRM interactions and email notifications. So I set that up with Salesforce, you know, and we started working with agencies to get the word out, and SEO and digital agencies with advertising. And I just was like, I kind of fell in love with digital marketing. I was like, wow, these amazing tools, and I can reach people from all over the world, and we can convert them, we can make money, and we can grow a business. But more importantly, like we can actually define a customer experience on here for specific customers and make it personal to them. And so the role kind of grew from like a 2 day a week customer service role. And then I went to 5 days. And then from there, I went and worked in conversion rate optimization, which is A/B testing, personalization for a number of like retail brands. And then from there, I worked at the Loomery, which I've just finished up recently for 4 or 5 years. And really, the Loomery is like an enterprise marketing technology business. So what they do is they help large enterprise companies with their marketing tech strategy. So I was doing a lot of the strategy work, like how do you meet customer experiences, customer needs with marketing technologies? How do you deliver on your outcomes? Things like that. And I worked with banks, telecommunications, airlines, nonprofits, you know, all kinds of companies from all over, medical, all kinds of companies from all over the place, and some international, some mostly local in Australia. And I think during that time, I just set off this fire of curiosity. I mean, I was just so fascinated by like all these amazing technologies that you can use, and literally you can go and learn how to use them. And then it could mean the difference, like with some of the companies we're working with, just the right execution of some of these marketing tech platforms was meaning additional $3-5 million a year in revenue, you know. And it's completely life-changing for the digital marketing teams when they use these technologies well. And so I found that, like it was just absolutely fascinating. And then during that period, and this was through COVID, I found that every man, woman, and child and their dog had some form of newsletter, right? Because everyone was shifted online. I mean, you know, like if you think about it, most of marketing technologies are bought and sold in person. It's a very heavily sales reliant process. A lot of people in sales, in the boardrooms, meeting with people at the cocktail parties, at the conferences, spruiking their stuff and managing leads. Can't do that anymore. So what do? Everyone starts a podcast. Everyone gets a newsletter up and going. Everyone gets on social media, starts posting a lot. You know, maybe you do a lot of webinars. And I found that like just through COVID, it was just a deluge of information. And here I am trying to, you know, advise executives on what's their five-year strategy in, say, like retailing and how they're going to use marketing tech. And it's like, how, it's very hard to figure out what's the signal in this, right? Like, there's so many different technologies and so much change that, like, okay, well, where do we even start with planning for the future of where technologies are taking marketing? And so that's what kind of led me to the MarTech Weekly, and then I've been building it ever since. It's literally started as a Friday LinkedIn post saying, hey, you know, these are the interesting things that are interesting this week. These are the things that I think what matter in MarTech, the stories, the news, the acquisitions, the legislation change, the new tech that came out. And I just started posting, and then over 3 months, I reached 30,000 people. And then after that, I started the actual newsletter proper because people were asking me, hey, where can I start with my email address? I'm like, okay, let's start that up. And then I've been working on it as a side gig. So I've been working full-time and doing it every Sunday for about 3 years. And I've just gone full-time about 4 or 5 months ago. And it's been a wonderful journey of exploration. I mean, more than anything, like building a business and building an audience, as you probably well truly know, Kerry, it's those things are wonderful, and to have a following is really interesting. But like the most rewarding thing is actually the intellectual pursuit. It's the creation of knowledge. It's the learning about these amazing technologies and helping others understand what's going on in such an amazing dynamic space at the moment. So that's a bit of a long-winded story. If I go back to the top, I would say, yeah, curiosity is probably the through line there of like, yeah, like learn about the things that you're genuinely passionate about. And for me, it's MarTech.
Follow the rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah.
MarTech is certainly a rabbit hole, and we're going to unpack that in a second in terms of some of the trends you're seeing and what we should do about them. But before we get there, tell me about a challenge you're currently facing. You've got, are views completely shifted to being an entrepreneur? Were you working full-time for a company and now you're an entrepreneur? Like, What's that leap you've made? And then within, you know, with where you are now, what's a challenge you're facing?
That's a great question, Kerry. I think, so I've been about 5 months in now, and I kind of towards the end of last year, I shifted into working about half my week on the MarTech Weekly as it started to grow. But we launched a pro subscription, as you mentioned earlier, which is a paid subscription. It's $3.99. And basically the subscription itself is our main driver. So our customers are our readers. They pay for our premium content, and we want to deliver for them every single week. And I found that literally coming out of a business, being an employee to being an entrepreneur, a company owner, you've got like unlimited options, right? Like you could literally do whatever you want. You know, you don't have a manager that's giving you progress updates or, you know, telling you how you're doing. You kind of have this vast sea of indifference, you know, and I think if you're wanting to be an entrepreneur, the thing that you have to be prepared for the most, and something that I definitely wasn't prepared for, was that most people do not care. Like literally, and if you're a marketer, it's the same deal applies. Most of your customers just do not care. There's a vast sea of indifference. They won't give you feedback. They won't coach you. They won't, you know, give you the insights that you need maybe to make critical changes. There may be a small group of people that really passionately care, but most people don't. And I find that obviously, you know, it's not fun, but it's also incredibly freeing because they don't care, you know. So it means you can do stuff and they still don't care. But I think that there's a couple layers to this, because the first thing is that when you do something and launch something and you create something, you're like, for example, for us with the MarTech Weekly 100, it's an awards event tracking from first place to 100 place the most innovative marketing tech companies. When you put something out in the world, you know, maybe your mom will text you and say congratulations, you know. and it's one of those things that, like, as an entrepreneur, you have to be extremely patient, because when you're doing media and you're doing content, it's one of those things where in 5 years from now, people will care, but most people don't care when you're starting out. And so you have to be prepared for like the vast sea of indifference. Like most people won't care or might care. And then, so that's one layer, is like, you'll get a lot of crickets. The second one is, your best followers will not be your best customers. And this is a really interesting learning. Like, so I had, you know, a bunch of people that would give me feedback every week. They're emailing me about our newsletters and the content, our podcast as well, you know, supporters sharing it, you know, just incredible encouragers. When I launched the pro subscription, those people weren't buying. They weren't the ones buying subscriptions. It was actually the people we had no idea about, people in Europe, people we've never met before, and had no idea, but they've obviously been following along. They're the folks that are buying. And so you can have your cheer squad and you can have your customers. Which one do you want to pick? You know, and I would say you want to focus on your customers because those are the people that are transacting with you. But your cheer squad is not necessarily going to be a customers. And I thought that, yeah, you know, got an awesome following, great group of people that really support me, but none of them are pulling their wallets out, you know. And I thought that was like, whoa, a big realization for me that, well, as a business owner, actually your customer, it can be so different from the people who are actually really highly active with your products.
I will say, in my own experience, something that I learned a little late, I wish I figured out sooner or had been paying attention to sooner, is that you're right. There's a difference between your cheer squad outside of your parents. We're not talking about our parents. They're always going to cheer us on, my mom. And the people who are going to pay and pull out their wallets. In my experience, you need both. Peter Wheeler, who's been on my show before and who now I'm good friends with, talks about this as being like a referral friend, right? Those people that you come to really know and get along with who aren't necessarily going to be your customers, but you build trust with to the point where when they hear about a problem that you can solve, they immediately say, oh, you need to go talk to Juan Mendoza or you need to go talk to Carrie Gard. Like, it doesn't even... they don't even question who you should go talk about to go solve that problem because they know you so well where the folks are interacting with don't. And so I would encourage people in my experience to not lean into one or the other. I would say you need both.
Yeah.
It is a bit time consuming to try and build that audience. And if you do lean one way or the other, you do get a little caught off guard. Like, how do I have this big audience of folks who like I love talking to, but like I'm getting nowhere with sales. And then you have this wonderful customer base, but then you like plateau at some point and you're like, this is great, but like I'm not growing past this and what's happening. And so, you know, like I said, it's nice to have both, that if you can build it simultaneously. And I'm not just saying that's easy. It definitely takes energy. Content is a great way to do both. What's in your experience? You said you have those cheerleaders and you have those customers. Is the content leading you to both of those, or is one leading you to more one side than the other? What's been your experience in that?
No, I think it's like a really great topic to actually unpack, because if you're creating content, you're trying to build an audience, there's two things that can happen that I think are what I would call like an anti-pattern, things that you probably don't want to fall into. The first one is parasocialism, and the second one is audience capture. So parasocialism is this idea, and it's been around for a long time, but it's this concept of like when you have people following you and listening to your voice on podcasts and reading your content or your blogs, and maybe they're seeing you on live shows like this one, those people that follow you feel like they know you. But me personally, I don't know them. So there's an imbalance or an inverse in relationships between the people that follow you and the people that you personally actually know. And so when I go, say, you know, it was a little while ago, I went to a conference, it was an Australian conference, and did a talk. And I found that it was extremely exhausting because like all these people wanted to talk with me. And after I did a keynote, I spent like 45 minutes talking to seven or eight different groups of people, but they all came up to me wanting to have a conversation or a coffee chat or whatever, because they feel like they know me, but I actually don't know them at all. And that creates a very weird, very, I think, unhealthy dynamic. You know, and so you have to balance that, right? Because when people are listening to you and, you know, they're engaging and consuming your content, they get a sense, and that's the para aspect of the parasocialism, is that they feel like they know you, but in reality, they don't actually know you. You know, what I create for my content, my own personal life, my best friends, my family, very separated from my media business, you know? So that's the first challenge, right? It's like, okay, well, how do you deal with that? I think that's an interesting aspect, because you don't want to be friends with everyone. You just can't, right? Like you've got to prioritize the relationships in business and in life. So you can't be a friend to everyone. You can't say yes to all of those invitations for a coffee catch up, unfortunately. But you know, when it makes commercial sense and when it's good for your business, then great. You know, if it's good for your research, awesome. So it's the first one. The second one is this audience capture aspect. And you find this particularly with like people that do a lot of content for like the consumer side, not for business, where you have people that create content. And then particularly on YouTube, it's got this really interesting algorithmic dynamic where a lot of people will that are building YouTube audiences, they end up looking like Mr. Beast, you know? And if you know who Mr. Beast is, he is the like the algorithmic optimizer in chief. Like he's learned the YouTube algorithm like inside and out. And what's really interesting is that audience capture is this idea of you, okay, you're getting good feedback, good traction, customers, audience, sponsors, and you're growing this this content channel, but you can increasingly do what the audience wants you to do. You know, you're engaging. And then there was this one story, I can't remember the fellow's name, but he does mukbang, which is this, it's an Asian YouTube content genre, which is basically like eating food in front of a camera. And his guy is based in the US and, you know, it's really popular. It's a really interesting, weird niche. But he started eating food in front of a camera. He's a skinny guy. And then 5 years later, he's eating trays of McDonald's and he is like huge, right? And extremely unhealthy. And that is probably the most extreme edge of like audience capture, which is basically this guy has realized, okay, if I continue to eat like these crazy, unhealthy foods in huge portions in constantly in front of the YouTube, I'm going to drive a huge audience and the audience is going to want more of that. And so like the audience capture bit is really interesting for me personally. Again, it goes back to like, what are you here for? For me, it's to explore the unknown in MarTech, right? Like is to actually understand that. But as you get feedback from algorithms, from your newsletters, from your podcasts of what engages and what doesn't, it's very easy to fall into that trap of audience capture, which is creating for the audiences that what they want, not necessarily what you think they should have. So I think those are two things, right? Like I could talk for days about this topic because it's fascinating the imbalances and the, I guess, the misalignment between audiences and the content creators and how they actually work, how those things work together and all the anti-patterns and traps that you could potentially fall into.
Yes, that is a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
I am here for and also terrified to unpack given that one person who gained all that weight. I personally love doing these shows because it feeds my own curiosity because I am like you. I like to go down the rabbit hole and unpack these topics that I don't yet know about. And then I get to learn about them and then I end up going on my own fact-finding missions and lose days in the realm of Google and ChatGPT. So I'm with you in what it serves for me personally. Maybe it's a blessing and a curse and maybe why I haven't really grown my audience. I sort of like peaked at the 4,500 LinkedIn and, you know, maybe I'll crest into the 5 to 10 and I hope to do that, but that's not what it's there for me. I'm there to make connections and relationships like with people like yourself. And the audience numbers are a byproduct of that, right? So I love having these interesting conversations. I think it's more valuable to have them not in a bubble where people can't hear them because they're always so interesting. And I'm like, oh man, I wish I was recording, right? So that's why I do them. And I think it's really important. I love what you're saying. And I'm harping and I'm doubling down on it because I think it's important for people to decide to do something like this in terms of creating content or building an audience with purpose and remembering what that purpose is so that you don't get caught up in the fame of it, the parasocialism, or the audience capture of doing what your audience thinks they want you to do versus what you want to be there for and known for. Such a good point.
And like in our world, I want to add one more comment here because I think it's important is that in the world of business, particularly in B2B content, because that's our world, right? Like in marketing, our audiences are of course people who come to us because of business reasons. You know, they want to grow their career or they want to you know, do better at what they're doing with their job and their companies. But what I found is that a lot of people will want to outsource their opinions to you. And it's, again, another fascinating aspect of building an audience online is that people will take your content and use it as their own opinions. Because a lot of, and like, and it's totally normal. I've done it. I often do it, right?
Yeah, we all
and it's very normal. And it's a, and again, it's another scientific word, which is memetics, right? Like we want to, and it's like the construct of memetics is memes, right? We want to copy each other, right? And copy each other's opinions and views and evidence and arguments and all of those things. But it's actually really valuable. So when you think about creating content, what you're doing is you're giving people opinions they can use. They can, with their boss, with their team, with their own thinking. And people want to outsource those opinions to you, right? And so when you have people that have a conflict with that, right, when they don't have those opinions, you get a lot of negative feedback because they're like, oh, that totally disagrees with my view or my opinions. But a lot of people, I think most people in business, are more than happy to outsource their opinions to others. I think the vast majority of people working in marketing are happy to outsource their opinions and to get their opinions from somewhere else instead of actually thinking critically for themselves. And that's the difference between, I think, a good content creator, a great one, is that they're free thinkers. I think these are the people that they are happy to explore and think and criticize themselves and criticize other other ideas and concepts because they want to think clearly and think freely. And one of the best ways to do that is to create content because content is just thinking. Like writing is thinking, podcasting is just thinking, right? All of it is just thinking on a page or thinking on a stream. So I think that's another aspect, which is, again, is quite fascinating, is that people would want to also outsource opinions. So you're doing them a favor because they may not have an opinion on something until they listen to you or read you.
There's so much to unpack there. Well, because I want to get on my high horse like real bad and talk about this. So let's spend not even 5 minutes because we will lose our hour in this for sure. I think the challenge I'm having with that, it's totally happening. It's completely happening. And the challenge I'm having with that is that it's creating a dichotomy of people who want to put out very clear opinions, advice, I call them advice monsters, around what people should do because I'm telling you to do it. And it's not rooted in any experience. There's no context to it. It's just, I just saw Chris Walker do this around SEO and how 3% of your SEO should go towards pipeline because it's really coming from word of mouth. Branded SEO, yes, right? People are hearing it through the grapevine. They're understanding that that might be the company for me, and they type in your company name, click on the top result that has your company name in it, and then gets to your website, and then that's being attributed to SEO. Totally agree, right? But he's blatantly saying SEO is getting 75% of your revenue when it's only should be 3%. It's like, there's so much nuance in there. So can we stop? Like, it's so link, like, I just want the link bait. So I'm going to make this blatant comment. And people listen to him. He's got a huge following. What he says matters. And I think he should be taking more responsibility for that. And I think more people in his, I think David Gearhart does a little bit better job of taking responsibility and talking about his experience and what he's doing at Exit 5. At Exit 5, here's the experience we're having with this thing that we're doing. Yeah. And he's taking responsibility for that. And I think we could all do a better job of storytelling and rooting it in our own personal experiences than saying, this is what you should do. And here's why. For no other reason than to be telling you to.
I want to ask you a question, Carrie, if you don't mind. I know you're interviewing me, but I'd love to ask you a question. what did you study at university? Did you study marketing? Whoa, there we go. What's that?
I studied photography.
You studied photography. Okay. So it might be a bit different because I guess from when I did my university, I did it in theology and philosophy. So it was majority was essay writing, actually. It was like writing. Well, you know what they teach you at university is that you get a bad grade if you have a singular opinion. You have to actually discuss and have a discussion with the evidence. You have to weigh the evidence. You have to go, you know, here's evidence for, here's the evidence against your thesis or your proposition and you argue it, right? Yep. What we see on LinkedIn is and on Twitter as well, and for a lot of B2B influencers, is the complete opposite of that. You know, we actually, the algorithms actually incentivize the worst intellectual behavior, because what we actually taught in universities and what a professional would learn, particularly in academia, would be you have to weigh the evidence for and against. You know, you have to show your thinking for, for and against. And when we see this culture of hot takes, of contextless advice, as you mentioned with Chris Walker, what we're seeing there is not folks that are thinking rigorously or intellectually about these topics, but folks that are captured by the algorithm. You know, I mentioned audience earlier about audience capture. There's also algorithm capture as well. Like, you know, the algorithms, the social feeds, the things that are optimizing, they go, oh, you know, if we do a hot take, you know, for example, Scott Galloway is a good example of this, right?
Yep.
He'll write in his No Mercy, No Malice newsletter or in his podcast, he'll have hot takes about all kinds of things. And it's one-sided opinions. He's not very, you know, not a lot of depth there in terms of the arguments, not a lot of nuance, because people don't want nuance. People just want a hot take and an opinion. And that's a really great way to grow an audience fast. But you know what? The audience amount does not matter compared to its quality. Right? Who is actually listening and reading to you, reading your stuff, is actually way more important than the volume, right? And so what you find with B2B influencers with large LinkedIn followings is that they'll try to do these like very inspirational, almost self-help type stuff, like Simon Sinek. Like, he is the worst culprit at this stuff, right? Like, he is the guy that's like, start with why. You know, he has these very funny 2-minute clips about leadership. And really, he's just leveraging other people's insecurity. Like, that's what he's doing. It's not very rigorous, again, intellectually. But like, and then you have the guys that are like advice givers that is very one-sided, one point of view and not very like reasoned. And so I think for us with the MarTech Weekly, the audience that we engage with the most are people in senior leadership that have that need that to actually discuss and to explore some of the evidence on both sides. Like, most of my essays are not like one hot take. It's like, this is for, this is against, and these are the sort of arguments for each, and kind of this is where we sit on this topic. You know, for example, is the metaverse dead? Well, there's arguments for and against. There's still some big deals and some big venture funding happening in the metaverse right now. But it's also, you know, the amount of people on Meta's Horizon Worlds, which is their, like, you know, their landmark MarTech product, is abysmal, right? There's no customers in there, right? And but then you have like, this is not just individual content creators. This is like massive firms as well, right? So McKinsey, as an example, put out a report 2 years ago saying that the metaverse is going to be worth $5 billion by 2030. You know, and it wasn't just McKinsey. It was Accenture. It was Bain. It was all the big consultancies. They're all saying these huge forecasts, right? Because the $5 billion in 2030 is a really cool headline, right? And it captures attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hot take, not on a nuance. What happened to the metaverse? Well, it's in the bin. And so, and so when I see, like, I was at a conference in Las Vegas just a couple of weeks ago, and I was at the conference, and there was a guy that was coming to speak. I follow his newsletter, and I was sitting with the editor in chief of the media company that owns the conference. And I said, "But you should probably watch out for this guy, because he only does one sided points of view. He doesn't look at the evidence." And as he was speaking, I was just sort of talking with her at the same time, and I was like, as you can see, this argument here that he makes about like tech is dead and whatever, you know, he made a point about layoffs, I think, and, you know, how big tech has done a lot of layoffs. But I also said, well, if you look at the research, big tech's actually hired more people than they've laid off in the past 3 years, you know. And so I was kind of going through his arguments as he was speaking. I said that, you know, this is not wrong, but he hasn't added this nuance to his arguments. But he's got a big following, and he has a very aggressive, very angry hot takes. But again, it's like, if you want to live in a world of hot takes, you know, that's a place for imbeciles. Like, that's my view, right? That's a place that you're not going to learn, you're not going to grow, because hot takes get you nowhere, right? What you said before is spot on. Like, learning from others' experience and how they wrestle with things is fantastic, but taking your opinions from hot takes is probably a road to nowhere. That's my view.
The last thing I'll say about it, and then I want to move on because I'm excited about our conversation, but I do think this is a really important moment for folks. I hope they're leaning in and paying attention to this idea of steering clear of hot takes, or at least like leading with a hot take, but then balancing that, I think, is really important. Because one of the challenges I'm having with LinkedIn in particular right now, and X, Threads, whatever, is that it's creating it's creating polarization, and it's us versus them, and your idea versus mine,
yes,
and not giving us space to live in the middle and in the gray and in the ick of like what the reality is, which is data, which is MarTech, which is the the customer journey in this messy middle, like our clients and founders wanting, we're putting $10 in, where's our $100 back? And it's like, let's unpack the nuance of this. And let's talk about the timing of when these things are going to happen. And let's talk about learning through your customer journey, because every customer journey is different, and what optimizations, like it is no longer linear, and trying to put us in these boxes of yes, no, and forgetting the and is really dangerous on so many levels. And is, I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but it is one of the reasons why the left and the right have gotten so left and so right. Like, we need to come back to center, y'all. And part of that is looking at both sides of any argument.
Yeah.
And not just relying on the hot take. So yes to that one. I'm here for it.
That's great.
Let's talk about one of your hot, quote unquote, hot takes that we're going to unpack and give a lot of context to, which I'm excited for.
Hopefully, yes.
is around what's happening in the market in regards to how it's changing in a way that's going to sort of throw us back to the future. Scooted there. Talk to me a little bit about what the changes have been in the market that you've seen, and what opportunities reside with those changes.
So, I mean, I think right now is one of the most fascinating times to be working in digital marketing, full stop. I just think that there is so much change. You know, we had a once in a lifetime event, which is COVID-19. And at the center of COVID-19 was, of course, a pandemic, which was just horrible. And it impacted so many millions of people, and so many people passed away. But in the center of that, we had the internet. I mean, you know, last time we had a major outbreak of a pathogen was the Spanish flu back in the, I think it was 1904. Yeah, very, very early in the 20th century. And so they didn't have the technology to facilitate relationships and communications at scale like we do to now. So if we look at ourselves historically, over, say, a period of 100 and 150 years, we've had all these things line up for digital marketers that we've never had before. We've had the internet become mature enough that marketers can use it. You know, like if you go back to the like the 90s, the early 2000s, very hard to do marketing online purely because it was a world of developers. And like the foundations weren't being built. The internet wasn't fast enough. It wasn't in your pocket with your smartphone, you know. So we reached a point of maturity, an apex point of maturity, with how marketers can actually use data and content and experiences online. And then we had COVID-19, which shuffled all the commerce online for a short period of time. And then we've come out of that into this really unusual malaise, right? Like we're in this period of high inflation here in Australia. And I think most parts of the world, inflation is like crazy. Interest rates are crazy, economic crunches here. And what this has done is created all of these second order effects. Now, I think the first thing to think about is, well, when I was working consulting, when we, in the middle of COVID-19, there were companies that unlocked magically millions of dollars in budget for marketing technologies, because like, crap, we've been sleeping on this, where we don't personalize anything for our customers. Our app is like, feels like it's been built by a teenager in a bedroom, and it looks like it has escaped 2005, you know. Our analytics and our ad tech, when the only way we can find customers right now, because people aren't actually walking by stores, is, yeah, we don't have that data. We don't have that access, right? And so all of these companies spent millions and millions of dollars. And through that period, from 2020 to 2021, we saw some of the biggest acquisitions in MarTech. We saw, Salesforce acquire Evergage, which is a CDP. And, you know, they've repackaged it into their own customer data platform, which is a way to manage your customer data. They made that acquisition. You had EpiServer acquire Optimizely, which is EpiServer's, it was like a CMS platform. They acquired Optimizely to enable personalization A-B testing within their own suite of products. We had Intuit, the folks behind TurboTax, acquire MailChimp. MailChimp, of all things, right? MailChimp, unbelievable success story. Definitely look it up. But MailChimp was a, they're a small to medium business. Email marketing tool has been around forever. And Intuit's like, no, we're going to acquire this business because companies will need to interact digitally with their customers. Small businesses will need to do that. And they're creating their own portfolio. So you had all these acquisitions, but it's actually driven by like really cheap capital, a lot of venture funds going into MarTech, a lot of funding, a lot of acquisitions. But underpinning that was just a lot of big enterprise companies and a lot of small businesses were needing to use these tools. So we saw these two periods from 2020 to 2022, midway, early 2022, we saw this period of extreme growth. And then we got, and then we get into this, what I call this period of fantasy, right? So we had like the metaverse. You remember Mark Zuckerberg, he did this fantastic video on the metaverse and this future, right? Because like from Mark Zuckerberg, from Toby from Shopify through to, you know, Sundar Pichai from Google, like all of these guys, they had this extreme optimism that the way that consumers are behaving now during COVID is going to be mostly retained after COVID. And that hasn't been the case. And so we had all these fanciful, crazy ideas, like the metaverse was so vaguely defined. Is it 3D worlds? Is it NFTs? Is it crypto? Is it Web3? You know, and we were captured by hype. A lot of that was just hype. And then now we're moving into post-COVID where it's, all of this is actually even turbocharged by things like generative AI, large language models, and that's the hot thing at the moment. But what's this done is actually just accelerated the hype cycles for a lot of these technologies. So what I, when I talk to marketers, right, one of the challenges, one of the problems right now and the changes is just dealing with the hype. Like, what's hype and what's real? You know, should we use generative AI in our business? Well, these marketers are asking the same question for the metaverse. Oh, should we have a metaverse strategy? This was back in 2020, 2021, you know? And so a lot of marketers need to explore these things and experiment, of course, but there's so much hype fueling this backdrop of new technologies or new technologies, new ideas that marketers are just completely confused by it. You know, I saw one job ad, I saw one person on their LinkedIn profile. They went from the, I think they're working at Coca-Cola, or at a consultancy, but they were like the chief metaverse officer. And then they were then they took the job as the head of Web3 technologies. And then now they're the head of generative AI, right? This guy's just made a career of like jumping from one hype cycle to the next. And like, you know, that's a pretty cool illustration of like, you know, right now, like COVID has created this crazy expectation that like most consumers want online experiences and most consumers want, you know, these fanciful ideas like the metaverse and NFTs and even generative AI and all of those things, where actually there's some really great arguments against those things. And so I feel like going back to our original points about, you know, just earlier was like, I feel like marketers have lost a bit of their capacity for like really being critical and critically thinking about the technologies they buy. I mean, even a latest research report from Ascend 2 this year say that I think that, more than 50% of marketers use less than half of their existing marketing technology stack. So the existing tech that they've already bought, they're using less than half of it. That's about 50% of marketers. And I look at that and I'm like, yeah, because we're in this sort of hangover, right? Like we bought a lot of stuff.
Oh my gosh, totally.
And a lot of marketers don't like, and the amount of brands I've worked with in the past that they spend upwards of $500,000 on these tools and it's literally on the shelf. Because they bought it with some expectation and they never put process and people around it, never trained their staff, never actually worked at the use cases to actually implement the technologies. And so I think if I could say anything just off the back of that, a monologue around all these changes is that I think we're heading into this period of like, I would call of extreme pragmatism, right? Because a lot of the ideas during COVID failed. A lot of the ideas kind of didn't peter out. A lot of people were left wanting. And then even with the marketing technologies they bought, a lot of them being underutilized. And so I think we're in a good 2 or 3 year cycle now of extreme pragmatism, cutting the budgets, you know, using tech less or using the tech you have. Yeah. Or sweating the stuff that you have at the moment instead of exploring new ideas. But, and that's not just the tech cycle, but it's also the economic cycle. I mean, my CMO budgets are being slashed everywhere right now. It's really hard to get that budget for tech anyway. Right. And explore those new ideas. So I think that's sort of the main thing is like, we're in this COVID-19 malaise. We're in this period. It's very tough to do marketing and a lot of the technologies are not really petering out, but that's my view.
I loved how you called it a hangover. It totally is. One of the things that I also feel like has changed in this shift from all this testing is the audience, like the how we have changed as consumers, both on the B2B and the B2C side. And I don't think we're in a place where we want the cold calls, where we want to engage with sales folks, where we want, we feel like we've sort of been in through using a lot of this tech and realizing they sold us. Here's a great example. So I'm not going to name names because they are a wonderful company and we've been with them forever. But I think they got a little, I think they lost sight of like what they were trying to do. And so we've been using this technology for a long time. And we're sort of ingrained with them and we pushed really hard to like figure it out. But now we're like, it's bigger than what we like. We've lost sight of like what it is we're really trying to accomplish.
Yes.
Because we've been trying to make this technology work for us and we need to get back to basics. And so it's caused us to just take a step back to say, what is it we're trying to deliver for our customers in relation to what it is we do at our core? And is this technology serving that? And if it is, then how do we make it work for us with the process and systems you're talking about? And if it's not, then we need to cut it loose and get back to something more simple that can do it for us in a more financially stable way. And so I know that I'm asking these questions. I know I'm not the only one. I do think there's going to be a tech renaissance of like, being really critical of this is the problem I'm having and you say you can solve it. Can you?
Yeah. Well, if you're working at a marketing technology vendor and you're doing sales, it is hard, right? You're sweating. Mm-hmm. It's a tough job because, you know, I think that there is this a concept of like a zero interest rate phenomenon, right? For example, if capital's cheap, right? If it's easier to raise funds and a lot of investors have capital to deploy, they'll tend to just deploy it on the craziest ideas, right? Because in venture capital, it's like you get one winner out of say 1,000 losers, you know, and it's very similar to like gambling in that way, right? You pick one winner and they'll get an entire return on your investment. The others won't. But that's like a zero interest rate phenomenon, right? When the capital's cheap, right? Like in a lot of businesses run on financing, when the capital's cheap, they can splash it around and explore these ideas and not have a real, concrete purpose. Like why get into NFTs if you're a company like an airline like Qantas, right? Like why would you do that? Or, you know, one of the example I use a lot, which is it's funny, but it's also extremely sad, is Walmart. Walmart launched a Roblox digital world, right?
Oh, no.
And like, so it's like a metaverse world. And it was like unusual, right? It was like this 3D world you can use in VR or use on your laptop. You can go and explore. And one guy on Twitter joined the live stream, like virtual event where the CMO gets on the stage and talks about the Walmart experience. And he gets on stage and there's like no other avatars in the crowd, right? There's just no one there. This is like early 2022. And you could see that they're exploring and these ideas and who knows how many millions that they've invested, whatever, into that kind of project. The European Union also had a similar like metaverse party where there was like a couple hundred people that turned up, you know, it wasn't very popular at all. And like, I like that because the failure rate is good. Like we should be failing at things quite a bit, you know, because there may be opportunities there. However, you're talking about people's jobs and you're also talking about the capital, the financial resources to make these things happen. And I just think that marketers are going to be way more pragmatic. I mean, I think that right now, and, you know, we haven't touched on a lot of other aspects, which is like privacy, it's changing the tech industry quite a bit because there's less data to use. So there's less opportunities with your data. So you have to be far more pragmatic and more privacy conscious about what you're doing. So that's one major change. But like, I feel like right now it's like, you got to be pragmatic. You have to spend your budgets wisely. This zero interest rate phenomenon is kind of over. And you know what? These things happen in cycles. Give us 2 years. Let's get to 2025, 2026, and we probably have another zero rate interest phenomenon again, where you have a lot of capital, a lot of spending, a lot of crazy ideas that never will work. And you know, I don't want to come off as pessimistic either. I think that these ideas, even though a lot of them have failed, it's kind of still worth trying, right? Because you've got to try. You've got to throw the spaghetti at the wall sometimes and figure out which ones will work and which ones won't. But when you see this like extreme, like it really broke my heart when I saw, for example, Shopify and Meta make huge amounts of layoffs, you know, because their ambitions didn't work out, or their expectation of COVID continuing, like the dynamics of COVID continuing, didn't peter out. Like there is a way of going about these new ideas and trying stuff, which isn't like literally risking the livelihoods of hundreds or even thousands of people. You know, and so as a CMO, if you're a marketing leader, if you're a person that's actually got a team, you have to think so seriously, because one bad investment could mean that half your team are gone next day. You know, mm-hmm. you have to let them go because you just can't substantiate them being around. And that really breaks my heart. We're talking about people's careers and livelihoods here. It's not just ideas and concepts. It's actually people working to make this stuff happen with passion and grit and determination. So I think that's one of the things to perhaps look out for is if you are a CMO right now, being pragmatic is probably a good season to do that, just because, you know, it is a very tough time right now to actually make a lot of these ideas work.
What are some ways that we can be pragmatic, right? So we threw a lot of spaghetti up against the wall. We try to see what would stick. We got caught up in the hype of it all. We're getting caught up in the hype of AI, whether it's hype or not is TBD, but in the moment of it being really new and us figuring it out, it's currently hype. I think we can all agree to that. It's probably being a bit overblown than what it'll peter out to be. It's definitely going to change the landscape, but to the degree we think it will, I don't know. Time will tell. We do still need to pay attention to and not lose sight of what has worked in the past or what used to work that we've forgotten about. In your experience, what are some of those things that maybe we need to dust off and bring back and say it used to work and it can work again? And let's go back to, I don't want to say basics. I think these were really, there's definitely stuff out there that's not basic, but that we've sort of lost sight of.
Yeah, this is a fantastic topic. I mean, I wish we had a little bit more time to talk about it, because it's right now, one of our themes in the MarTech Weekly is this back to the future, which is we're returning back to some of the foundations of what make marketing really great because of this pragmatism, because of this growing disillusionment with these tech trends and these hype cycles that are happening. But there are other shifts as well. I think right now I'm seeing a lot of companies that were very focused on digital ad spend actually return back to brand advertising, like out of home, you know, TVCs, you know, the mass market approach to marketing, and actually allocate their leadership and their budget to that. One really good example recently is Airbnb. They were very heavy on performance marketing for a long, long time, but they've actually just shifted over the past 6 months into very much focused on brand marketing, on actually getting their brand out there. And I think that's a really interesting one, because, you know, the divide between brand marketing and out of home and above the line, if you want to say it that, and then all the digital activities, like digital, the advantage of digital is you can measure things, right? You can do performance marketing. You can incrementally, you know, change things and get higher numbers. With the brand marketing, you're kind of, you know, experimenting a lot more. It's a lot more free form, you know, and you don't get those tangible metrics that you might like in attribution. So I think that's one area which I think is worth exploring, is like, okay, well, how can you go back and get your brand out there, not necessarily do this hyper-targeted marketing that you see with the performance digital advertising folks. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think that right now we're looking at options, particularly in the privacy challenges right now. So, you know, right now we have the GDPR, we have the CCPA, which are all these acronyms, basically different regulatory bodies. Down here in Australia, we have all these new regulations coming out. Massive shifts in tech. What's happening is that that's actually creating this pressure on the industry where privacy and data security are becoming more important. And we're seeing with unilateral moves from Google removing third-party cookies, and Apple with their Apple tracking transparency and all of their privacy changes across their devices and the ecosystem. like that is actually causing so much change. It's actually really hard to do mobile targeted ads now because of Apple's changes. Third-party cookies will make, like, I think martech.org say that from their recent survey, they said that 70% of marketers are still heavily reliant on third-party cookies. And so this world of like free-fettered, unlimited access to customers' data is coming to an end, right? We're heading to the end of that chapter on the internet, which is crazy, right? Like we've had, like I remember I worked with some insurance brands years and years ago, and I won't name them, but I worked with this brand and I was working on the email marketing and I literally downloaded a CSV, an Excel sheet onto my computer, and it had the personal details, their location, their insurance products, their names, you know, their email addresses, and of like literally millions of customers just sitting there, right? In a file. And I'm like, gosh. And that won't happen anymore, right? Those things where you can just, and that, it was valuable to me. I wasn't going to use it, but it was valuable because we can mine that data for insights and then and target people, segment them, right? But like we're coming to an end of those days, right? Which means that we're going to embrace old ideas. Like one example is contextual advertising. I wrote a piece on the MarTech Weekly called The Contextual Renaissance, which is this idea of targeting users with ads and experiences based on the immediate context of that page. So not tracking them from website to website or accumulating data or creating a profile, but what are they viewing right now? And what can we infer about that and then serve them an ad? It was really popular at the same time third parties came out in the late 90s and the early 2000s. It was the same. It was like two horses in the race. It was contextual advertising and then third party cookies. And both of them, if you look at Google Trends, both of them were extremely popular back in those days. But third-party cookies became the superior technology because of its efficiency in targeting. And contextual wasn't there because it was just not, it wasn't smart enough. It wasn't smart enough to infer context in real time. The data wasn't there. It was, just wasn't there.
It was also more expensive because it was limited space. So because the space was more limited, it was more expensive than just following your audience around to wherever they were. And then paying lower CPCs. So the dollar one, essentially.
Exactly, right? It became more expensive. It's hard. It's more siloed. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing a renaissance of that now. Like there's some fantastic startups like Gum Gum and CTag. They've just done a fresh round of funding, both of them this year. I mean, those folks are fascinating just because they're bringing AI into this picture, generative AI. And we didn't have this technology before. And so now you can actually scale and get much cheaper, CPC, CPMs just off the back of contextual advertising. So we're seeing this interesting renaissance. And you know what's great about contextual is that it doesn't require you to do this extensive data tracking on people. So it's actually privacy positive, privacy safe. And so that's, I'm looking at that as like an underdog, you know, they were really popular back in the day and they're coming back and you're like, oh, maybe, you know, it's like two, you know, horses in a race, right? You're at the greyhound race or the horse races. You're like, oh, maybe they're going to come back on the inside track and, you know, win the day. You don't know. But what I'm saying is that in this context of like, of an increasingly private web, we have to look at alternatives like that. And contextual has just been around, and there's been some fantastic new companies working on solving that problem in unique ways. So I think that's probably what I'd mention. I turn to brand and looking at old technologies coming new again will probably be my main two at the moment.
We could talk about this for days. I have a gazillion questions around the brand piece. I am a believer. I think that demand gen is going to be split into two, in terms of going after brand and then capturing that on the lead side. I believe the privacy is having a huge impact on how we are now leaning more into contextual site direct buys, community, and creating our own first party instances where we can capture an audience and cultivate that in the long run. Is all coming out of the fact that third-party cookies are going to be dead, essentially. And we need to get back to that first-party insight in a whole bunch of different ways. So if you want to learn more about Back to the Future and the renaissance of these technologies, please subscribe to Juan's newsletter. It is the, which one is, you have a couple. So which one's this one in particular?
Oh. So the newsletter is the MarTech Weekly. You can go to the martechweekly.com. And that's our, you get a free Sunday newsletter with our SA deep dives. And then there's our pro subscription, which is our Wednesday, which is a recap of everything that happened in the week in MarTech.
Go subscribe. I'm about to. It's going to be great. Juan, I know we're over time, but I do want people to know that you're more than a marketer. So can you tell us, in the days of COVID, I know it was now 3 years ago, but it has changed more than just our professional lives. It's certainly impacted our personal lives. Is there any new hobbies that either you picked up or you brought back to life, given that you had maybe a little bit more time on your hands during those lockdown days?
Yeah, I think one thing I actually picked up, which was such an incredible, I've got two young kids. So I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. So being at home with family was just incredible. I mean, it really rocked my world in terms of living and working and how that should be done. I worked in an office 5 days a week. And so I never saw my kids when they were very young, but now I'm at home like 5 days a week and I love it. But what it's given me extra time for is actually music. So, you know, I produce music on the side. It's like a personal hobby I really enjoy. I've actually just started learning piano properly, but I think I've created about like 120 song ideas in different stages, you know, some complete, some are sketches, you know, and so it's like digital producing, you know, sampling and things like that. So that's a hobby I definitely picked up and I love it. It's such a great relaxing way to spend time and be creative in different ways. I mean, TMW is a very creative business. Like, we're constantly writing, creating, you know, doing all kinds of stuff. So I like the creative in a different format, which is music. So yeah, that's something that I've always, you know, done bits and pieces, but I never really actually got into it proper until COVID-19. It gave me that opportunity. So it's a great question. Thanks for asking.
If you need a viola player, I may know someone. kidding, half kidding. Yeah, no, I played the viola for a long time, for 15, 20 years. And then I put it down. And then when I moved to this island, I ran into someone who was a music teacher. And I was like, can I just see if my fingers still work? And she was like, sure. So 15 years later, I picked it up and the muscle memory's there. And
wow,
music's been brought back to my life. So I love yes to music, right? Like, just the creative outlet of that. I also find it's a great brain break. I can't think about anything else when I'm playing,
which is so important. Like, you know, for intellectual work, it's not, people think they're resting when they're sitting on the couch watching Netflix, and actually no, that's not rest. Rest is actually using your brain in a different part of your intellectual life, you know, like that's what I find the most refreshing part of it is. It's a totally different workout for your brain, but you come back refreshed because you take that time away. It actually forces you to not think about, you know, the day-to-day work of what we're doing, podcasting, you know, content and media and also marketing as well. So yeah, it's a great point you raise.
Wonderful. Juan, this was a hugely important conversation. I hope people are leaning in. If you haven't had a chance to listen to it, you listen to this in the recording, please drop us your questions. We will answer them, we promise. Yes, thank you so much. If you want to learn more about Juan Mendoza and TMW and the MarTech Weekly, please head on over to his LinkedIn profile and subscribe to all the things. Please do that. This episode was brought to you by MKG Marketing, the digital market agency that helps complex B2B brands get found via SEO, digital ads, and measures all the analytics. It's hosted by me, Carrie Gard, CEO and co-founder of MKG Marketing. And if you'd like to be a guest, please visit mkgmarketing.com to apply. Juan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was an absolute pleasure, Carrie. Thank you.